It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Amanda Hess is a freelance writer and Slate contributor who has received rape and death threats online. She says of her experience, "None of this makes me exceptional. It just makes me a woman with an internet connection." In her recent Pacific Standard piece, "Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet," she couches the issue of online harassment not as juvenile behavior and not only as a women's issue, but as the next frontier of civil rights. Amanda Hess, thank you for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC today.
Thank you for having me.
So it sounds like you've been dealing with online threats for a while now. You even pursued legal action over an internet stalker in 2009. Why write this article now?
You're right. I have been receiving these sort of threats since I started writing about in 2007. But most recently, this summer, I received another bout of threats, and I was able to sort of experience how police and technology companies respond to them. I've also been listening over the past few years to many women writing and talking about their issues with this. And I thought it was just the right time to not only tell my own story, but to really investigate how these huge institutions like law enforcement and technology companies are dealing with, or in most cases, not dealing with the issue.
And listeners, because we know that this is hardly a new issue and hardly limited to Amanda Hess's experiences, have you experienced harassment online? How have you dealt with the situation? And was there a resolution in the end that was satisfying enough? Also, what should be done? Join the conversation, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's go a little bit more into the story of what happened to you recently, and then I want to spend a considerable amount of our time on some of the structural problems that you just alluded to and what internet companies and the government and others should be doing that they're not doing. But your article starts with an anecdote about threatening tweets that you received from someone going by "headless female pig." You said this was not the first time someone had responded to your work by threatening to rape and kill you. Do you want to tell us more, to the extent that you're comfortable doing so, what was in these threats and what happened when you called the police?
Of course. So I was on vacation this past summer with some friends in Palm Springs, and I woke up at 5:30 in the morning because my friend had sent me a text message alerting me to a Twitter account that had been set up for the sole purpose of sending me threatening messages. So I sort of groggily checked them out, and it was about 7 tweets. They were all sent to me from this anonymous account saying things like, "I live in your state, I'm going to come find you and rape you and cut off your head," that it would be an instance of social violence that was important to take out on me. Also, you know, just calling me fat and stuff, which I thought was a little bit unnecessary. So after I received them, I was sort of unclear on what to do. I had no idea where they were coming from or who might have sent them. So I called the police. And of course, you know, because I was in Palm Springs, they sent me a local police officer who, you know, really has a very sort of small world that he works in. And when he came to my door, he said, "What is Twitter?"
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, I was sort of starting from a very basic point in trying to, you know, get police to even understand what was happening.
This wasn't exactly their online harassment bureau.
It was not.
And in the article, you list a number of really shocking threats that have been sent to some of your fellow female writers for their seemingly innocuous pieces. For example, you mentioned Alyssa Rose, who, after writing what she called a fluff piece about entrepreneurial lessons she learned from seeing The Dark Knight and in the process admitting that she hated the film, received comments like, "You are clearly retarded. I hope someone shoots and then rapes you." In your mind, is it any better or worse or more benign when these threats are made in response to feminist commentary as opposed to just, you know, whatever, an opinion about a movie in pop culture?
No, I really think they're coming from the same place, which is that some people, most of them men, don't think that women should be in certain spaces. And that includes writing about sex and feminism, which is what I focus on. But it also apparently includes writing about technology or movies or politics. And so I think we're seeing the same phenomenon no matter what the woman writes about or what field she's in.
Are these kinds of threats limited to women who professionally post online in the context of their work?
I think we hear a lot from people like me because I do, enjoy a platform and I have the ability to talk about this stuff. But I also found in my research that, every woman who uses the internet is at a higher risk of receiving threatening, harassing, sexual comments on the internet, whether it's on an online dating site or in a chat room or just in her personal social network.
Do we, as a society, have the legal infrastructure, in your opinion, to discourage or prosecute this type of online behavior?
I think it's a tricky issue because in many ways we do have the framework. So when I reported my recent threats in California, there are laws set up there that criminalize threats of bodily harm. So, you can't make a credible threat to rape and kill someone in my state. However, the technology sort of complicates that issue in a number of ways. One is that because, I didn't know where the threats were coming from, it was difficult for me to prove that, he did live in my state and could conceivably come and rape me and cut my head off. And that's something that we would only sort of be able to prove if police actually investigated the issue, tried to get his IP address, and figure out who he was. There are also laws against persistent harassment and stalking that apply, not only offline but online as well. But again, in my case, as someone who, has a persistent stalker who's been following me for several years, it's again impossible for me to prove if these different harassing messages coming from anonymous accounts are coming from the same person or just some random person who decided to engage with me threateningly for a few minutes.
Yeah. How did you manage to bring your case to court?
So actually, in 2009, when I received the first sort of serious instance of threatening messages, I knew who the person was because I had been working at a newspaper at the time, and so he both made threatening comments to me in the comment section of the newspaper. And of course, because we owned that platform, it was easy to see where the threats were coming from, what his IP address was. He also called me on the phone and left me voicemails, which I think is a little bit easier
Wow.
for police to understand. However, in that case, police, again, they didn't investigate the crime. I was in Washington, D.C., and it was pretty clear that police officers, took it as them having much more serious issues to deal with. And so I sought out a civil remedy, which was to get a temporary civil protection order, and I did for a year. When my protection order ran out a year later, he started emailing me again. So it was a band-aid, really.
How much do you think that your story is representative of the climate online for women? Because what you're talking about is an actual stalker who went to the extent of leaving you that kind of message, whose language online was very personal and very directly threatening to you. I live in your state. I'm going to come after you. What you were describing before, which is different than the kind of thing that you were describing, with respect to one of the other writers, like, I hope someone shoots and then rapes you, horrifying as that is. You were at another level of being stalked, of being personally directly threatened. So how do you see the larger landscape? How do you see how your experience fits into it?
I think you're exactly right. So many of the instances that I was dealing with in these two cases are criminal. But as you astutely pointed out, saying that you hope that someone dies or you hope that someone rapes someone is not a crime. It's just, you know, a vile message. And so I receive messages like that consistently. There are only a few that I sort of took the initiative to report to police because I thought that they were specifically criminal. But what you're seeing is harassers and people who threaten women who understand that. And so they will try to harass women in a way that they think they can get away with by either, you know, making their profile anonymous or by sort of talking around the letter of the law to manage to harass someone without making it a criminal threat. And I think the cumulative effect of harassment like that is very real. Women have to deal with, you know, a bunch of vile material just in the course of doing their jobs. And there's not a lot of legal frameworks to, you know, sort of remedy that or to discourage it among anonymous trolls.
So listeners, women in particular, we want to hear your experiences. Is it wholly different to be a woman online than a man because there is so much of this kind of language out there? 212-433-WNYC for Amanda Hess, and maybe you read her Pacific Standard piece about this, which has been passed around online so much. 212-433-9692. And let's take our first caller, Margo in Red Bank. You're on WNYC. Hi, Margo. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. Yes. Many years ago, I worked at Bell Labs and it was in university. And you remember how before there was the World Wide Web, there was DARPANET. And so it started from that. Mm-hmm. And so there were news groups and so forth. And I used to read the news groups and so forth, but I never actually posted. One day I decided I wanted to post a comment. And colleagues had told me, if you post a comment, be prepared to get flamed. And that is because it's anonymous, people write back and they can write really nasty things. And I did. I got flamed. Some people didn't like it. And they said, you know, whatever. They didn't know I was a woman. That was just the atmosphere back then. And I think there's still some of that culture that has bled over into the internet in general.
Yes. So obviously you post something, you're at risk of getting flamed. The sexual aspect of it, Amanda, what do you think could actually be done to change things? Is it mostly a matter of law? Is it mostly a matter of culture? Is it something that internet service providers, as a matter of business, should have a responsibility to provide? Where do you see the most important solutions coming from?
Well, I wish I had an easy solution. I think if we did, you know, it already would have been in place. What I found in writing my story is this tricky situation where many of the threats that are happening are criminal, and we would hope that they would be investigated by police. But police have very few resources to do that. In my case, they also had very little education on the internet in general. And that requires money that a lot of jurisdictions just don't have. Meanwhile, technology companies have all of the money in the world, and they have an accountability to their user base in order to keep people tweeting and signing up for Facebook and all of that. And yet they don't really have the interest or the authority to investigate crimes. And then laws, which can sort of be molded to address new technologies, I think is a good way to look in the future. But again, you know, laws move very slowly.
Lauren in Asbury Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
So I, like Amanda, am a feminist writer, and I actually wrote about this summer at Salon, that the kind of we see a lot of progressive people, even men, get negative comments. But the kinds of comments that women receive and that I receive every single day, aren't just you're stupid or that's dumb. It's always with some sort of gendered attack, like you're fat, you're ugly, you're a baby killer, you're a murderer, you're a lesbian, a lot of words that I can't say on the air. And it's not really a well-crafted discussion point to debate with you your feminist perspective. It's almost always sort of this ad hominem attack that because you are a woman and you're speaking in public, that therefore you don't have the right to basic human respect or decency.
And I guess, Lauren and Anna, you would probably agree that this is a reflection of life offline. It's, you know, a sliver of a bigger problem, street harassment. Jill Filipovich wrote a response to your piece on, as I'm sure you know, on Talking Points Memo called "Let's Be Real, Online Harassment Isn't Virtual for Women." So, Lauren, I'll go to you first. How much do you separate online and in-person harassment, or think this should just be seen as a reflection of, you know, what women have to deal with on and offline, or do we need to talk about these as separate realms?
I absolutely think that it's a reflection of the way women are treated in real life or in offline spaces. What the internet sort of does is give people a sort of sense of anonymity where they can just throw these things at you and hurl these sort of horrific insults at you and threats and feel like there's no repercussions. Whereas on the sidewalk, while I do get street harassed frequently, there is sort of maybe a little bit of a buffer that someone wouldn't necessarily want to go to that level that they always go to on the internet. But I think that the criticisms and the attacks that women experience online is a reflection of misogyny and sexism in offline spaces, and it's just translated into this new forum.
Anna, you want to weigh in? Amanda,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
So, yeah, no, that's okay. I think two things are going on here, and one is that, as Lauren said, a lot of the abuse tends to be sexual, tends to be focused on our bodies as opposed to our critiques. And that's obviously something we've seen in sexual harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment on the street. And this is one of the reasons that some legal scholars are beginning to look at it as a discrimination issue. The other part of that is the online writing world, like the tech world, is still extraordinarily male-dominated. And so there is a social, you know, need to encourage women to go into these fields. And that's a lot more difficult to do when they're facing outsized harassment just because of who they are.
And what would that change? Because certainly most men would be horrified by the fact that this behavior takes place on the part of you know, a tiny minority of people, I think it's fair to say. So what would it change if there were more women in the field?
You know, I think it would change the world. Women have a lot to contribute to society, and the fact that we, you know, are underrepresented, I think, only sort of boxes out new ideas from emerging.
Right. Bigger conversation. So that's not that. There's right. Obviously a lot more that would change for the better if there was more, you know, gender representation in the tech fields in general.
Yeah, and you know, one of the arguments in my piece is that if there were more women in the tech field, perhaps they could help innovate on this issue and come up with sort of new ways of dealing with it that protect speech while not protecting harassers. And as someone who is a journalist and not a programmer, I'm probably not the best person to suggest the ways that that might happen, but I'm confident that if more women got into that field and if men in that field began to see it as more of a legitimate issue, that we'd have, you know, better solutions for it.
And Lauren in Asbury Park, thank you very much for your call. How can this be made into a civil rights issue? You say another way to frame the debate is as a civil rights issue. How can it be made into a civil rights issue?
So there are some laws that are already in existence that see threats against people based on their race, their national origin, their religion as discrimination. And so if you are threatened online for your race, you could have a legitimate civil claim against your harasser because they have interfered with your economic opportunity. That law does not currently extend to gender, and so that seems like a fruitful place for legal reform. However, you know, civil remedies are also, you know, they take up time, and this is one of the arguments in my piece, is that this harassment in general, you know, takes a toll on women, but also because we are tasked with remedying it ourselves, to go after our harassers to get, you know, for example, in my circumstance, a civil protection order takes a lot of time out of my work day just, you know, so I can do my job without someone harassing me. So it's not a perfect solution. I think what, you know, some scholars have said is that if we sort of codify this harassment as discriminatory and open up places for women to make claims against them, that it will discourage some harassers from just, you know, casually engaging in this type of threatening behavior. It's not going to deter people who are, you know, hell-bent on doing it. But right now the volume is so high that I think, you know, some more attention and legal opportunities for remedying it could help diminish it.
We're talking with journalist Amanda Hess about her widely shared piece in Pacific Standard, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, and Suzanne in West Orange. You're on WNYC. Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My daughter received a series of bizarre emails ending in one with an actual death threat. And we got the county prosecutor involved, and they were able to identify his IP address, and he was prosecuted, and there was a restraining order imposed against him. And I think my basic point is that, number one, the legal system works in our case. We were lucky with that. And number two, I think this is an opportunity for cowards to very easily harass people who they would not otherwise harass. And I agree with everything that your guest is saying, that something bigger needs to be done, and people in the position to do that need to wake up and see what's going on, because this is terribly damaging. Thankfully, we have the restraining order, but until that was in place, my daughter was terribly fearful for her life.
How shocked were you by the fact that something like this happened to your daughter, who I presume is leading a more or less ordinary life?
Yeah, very, very, very ordinary. And it turned out that, unfortunately, the person who was doing this to her had, you know, some emotional issues. And, again, I don't think he would have done it if he didn't have the anonymity of the Internet. And, yeah, I think it's horrible. It's shocking to an extent, but then when you think about what goes on in the world, it's really not that shocking.
Amanda, anything you want to say to Suzanne?
First of all, that's great news. I'm so glad that the legal system worked in your case. And one sort of hopeful thing that I've seen on a very small scale is that the police force of Mountain View, California, which is, again, a very small jurisdiction, some of their officers have joined Twitter recently. And I saw when the police chief joined that some of his followers were sharing the story with him, and they had a conversation about it. And so I think on a very basic level, you know, police being aware that this is a serious issue could help. And civil protection orders are also, you know, while they are not a criminal fix, I think they can be helpful in a number of ways. One is that, you know, when I filed a civil protection order, I had, you know, a copy of all of these threats that this man had made against me, you know, sort of come into an institutional framework. And so it seems like there's more of a sort of line of proof that they actually happened, which gave me some peace of mind. And also it sets it up for the place where if they continue to threaten you, you know, someone going against a civil protection order is something that I think police understand better. So it can, for me, it was a Band-Aid for a year, but it was a good year, you know?
Yes, under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Suzanne, thank you. Thank you again for your call. I appreciate it. Our comments page is buzzing. There are all kinds of stories and questions. For example, Elizabeth from Jersey City writes, someone put my Facebook photo and naked pictures of someone else from the neck down and my phone number on Craigslist on their now-gone casual encounter section. She writes, I got hundreds of phone calls and text messages from men looking for a prostitute. It took Craigslist almost 24 hours to take the page down. The Jersey City police were not able to do anything, saying it was only a prank, I never found out who set up this page, but I am now more careful with my image online and what personal info is out there. Any reaction to that story?
Yeah, that's awful. That's also another sort of common tactic of online harassers to use, you know, our images against us. There are some laws that are beginning to address that. In California, we have sort of initial revenge porn law that's starting to engage in the visual aspect of online harassment. But I would also say that the reaction of the victim was very common, which is because these institutions totally ignore the problem, it causes some people to retreat from public life. So we have to be more careful about what we say, about how we use our images. And, you know, as a journalist and people in many fields are experiencing this, my image is really powerful. You know, appearing on the radio or on television is really important to my career. And so if we withdraw, it really sort of, again, it impacts our economic opportunities.
You become a victim in just trying to protect yourself preventively.
Yeah, it's true.
Here's somebody writing in with a request for advice. And this person writes, I was recently harassed online with horrible language out of the blue. He wasn't a stranger, but someone I knew in real life many years ago before I moved to New York City. He's located in another state. I've saved the screenshots of the conversation, and another friend sent me psychotic comments that he, I guess that guy, subsequently posted about me. It's likely I don't have to worry about physical safety since he's a known alcoholic who posts crazy content while drunk and deletes the next day. But should I be doing anything else to establish a record?
I wish I could give you definitive advice on that issue. I think one of the most confusing things about these situations is that we get all of this sort of conflicting advice from different people. So when I got my most recent round of threats, I had some people telling me, just ignore it. You know, again, it's probably not going to culminate in a physical threat. It would be ludicrous for someone to come to your house and cut your head off. It's not going to happen. And then I had people saying, you know, it's your responsibility to make a record of this, to let the authorities know about it. But again, when you do that, it's often very disappointing because there's not much that they can do for you. So I think one thing is to sort of know that whatever you do, there's no wrong thing to do. But what you have done, which is to take screenshots of something and then to sort of continue to monitor them in case it escalates, that's how I deal with the issue. And it's really the only power that I have, which is to personally, you know, keep my eyes open and to keep a record of everything that comes my way. I wish there was something better to do.
You've gotten a lot. And JM, I hope that helps you. She posted as JM. So there's advice from Amanda Hess. You received a lot of press for this article, as we've been discussing. Have a new round of death threats been a byproduct?
No. So I've been really blown away by how much positive and, you know, legitimate critical attention it's gotten, which is wonderful. I haven't gotten any more death threats. I have gotten sort of just like the general, you know, harassment or vile commentary that women receive on a daily basis in reaction to this story. So people just sending me emails saying that I'm a vagina with a head, stuff like that. Mm. Not criminal, but just unpleasant.
You're not deterred.
No. I mean, this is the only thing I know how to do. So I'm not sort of looking to make a career change at this point.
Amanda Hess is a freelance writer and regular contributor to Slate, who reports on sex, Hollywood, and technology. Her article, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, appears in the January-February edition of Pacific Standard. Amanda, thank you so much, and I know we have so many appreciative listeners.
Thanks a lot.
And you can keep posting your comments and talk to each other at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Coming up next, humorist P.J. O'Rourke. His new book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J. O'Rourke next. Stay with us.